The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. Our very special guest for the week this week is Tom Abafemi. Jesus, did I get your name right there, Tom? Director of Lean Digital. Welcome to the MadTech Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're delighted to have you. Lindsay Rountree, my trusty colleague over in Walthamstow, keeping it real, always laughing her head off at me. How are you today, Lindsay?
Did you get my name wrong there?
Did I say Lindsay? I didn't call you Linda, did I?
No, you didn't call me Linda. No, I think you called me Rountree.
Maybe. Not deliberately. Sorry, I don't know where that came from. First news story I wanted to chat through with the two of you this week is a really interesting story that's come out of India about a large group of startups, some of them very prominent tech startups in India, some 150 or so companies, who are working to form an alliance to produce their own app store, partly in response to Google announcing that they're going to be charging 30% commission on all in-app purchases. But also in response to a growing feeling and a growing sentiment in amongst particularly technology companies and app developers that there is far too much dominance from Google's Play Store in the Indian mobile market, since they control some 99% of the market. It was also inspired somewhat by one of India's fastest growing startups, which is a payments platform called Paytm, that was kicked out of Google's Play Store last month for allegedly violating their gambling policies. And it just sort of, gave me remnants of Epic Games versus Apple only about a month or so ago as well, and made me wonder if this is as much a story about pushing back on the dominance of global tech companies as it is also a story about trying to instigate a degree of, shall we say, diversity and innovation in the local tech marketplace. So really keen to hear your thoughts. Tom, what was your perspective on this story?
Yeah, I think it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, obviously Google have so much power and share, and it's, for whatever the reasons are, obviously around the sort of gambling, I think we've all fallen foul as advertisers and, app owners of approvals and disapprovals, sometimes it feeling very arbitrary. And I think it's, arbitrary decisions from Google. And this is just a reflection of that control. And it's that growing frustration, isn't it, across a lot of different, tech startup community there in India. It's just sort of pushing back, having more control and more say over the rules of the game. And it's difficult, I mean, they're coming off the back of it saying, can we, build our own sort of platform, or can we do something different? But even still, it's, is it going to be as good as the Play Store? Can it even really compete? And like the effort and sustained effort, investment, everything that would require to even sort of go there is, it's just vast. And it's just, they have to do something to show, their, to try and get back some of this control, but it's just so difficult. It's so difficult. And it's similar to, with the Facebook boycott, for example, a little while ago, again, that rallying against big tech. It's how much of an impact and a dent does that actually have on them? So it's more really a sort of, we want to rally, but it's also very difficult to really hurt them. But it's really a start.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. It's a bit of a case of, are we trying to close the gate after the horse has bolted? Is it too late in the day once, in this particular example, since Google's got such a massive share of the smartphone market in India, is it a little too late to try to, mix that marketplace up a bit? Lindsay, what's your point of view?
I think I agree with Tom. I don't think it would be particularly successful. I think that... As Tom says, Google are so vast, the Play Store is so vast, and in terms of mobile consumption, Google just has, it's like shooting fish in a barrel for them, really. It's easy for them to do. But I think the problem with India is that India is such a fast growing market that they are realizing that they're kind of growing almost too fast, and as a result they're being taken advantage of, and they want to try and make sure they are able to retain some kind of some isolation in some of the things they have control over. And Tom kept saying it, the word control I think is really important here, because India wants to be able to control what kind of companies can and can't do business in their country. And that makes a lot of sense. We've seen it with Amazon already. India have, you know, with Amazon trying to sell their own brands to kind of usurp existing Indian brands and trying to sell its own stuff over and above that on Amazon Marketplace. Amazon are no longer allowed to do that. So India have precedence of India going to these big tech companies and saying, this is what you can and can't do. And Amazon didn't say, you know, we're going to do it, we're going to pull out the market. Amazon didn't do that. And Google can't afford to do that either. Google would be, particularly Android, would be nothing without Asia, because Asia is obviously a mobile first market, and Android is the dominant operating system that's over there. Like Apple iOS is much more of a US thing, much more of a European thing, but in Asia it is all Android. So Google would need to be able to work out how to play games with these countries as they keep growing, and as they start realizing they're being abused, being taken advantage of. These things will keep popping up. I kind of feel the same thing will happen in the likes of Indonesia and those kind of like massive growth markets as well. So Google will need to work out how they can play ball with those markets rather than annoy them, because I feel like this app store that these startups trying to create is great in theory, but it's great for that business is behind it, but our consumers behind it. And if consumers aren't behind it, then these big companies will struggle. If consumers can find a similar app on the Play Store that they're already using, they'll probably go after that as well. Because, you know, consumers don't have loyalty. They are very, very fickle people. They will do what's easier, not what's right. And as consumers, as India is becoming increasingly global, the consumer aspect of this needs to be thought about as well. It's great that big business is backing this, and India is being very supportive of its own. But it needs to get the consumers on board as well to actually really make it work. But if they fight hard enough, I think they could bring sanctions against Google. There's no reason why they wouldn't try to, because we've seen them do it in the past.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, the article that we all read in prep for this conversation cited that, you know, there's been quite a lot of frustration, particularly amongst this startup community, at how industry associations and organisations in India have approached the matter. And so it's, you know, they're sort of, I suppose, signalling in their desire to bring together this coalition of startups that they want a number of industry bodies and a number of associations that have got power and influence to do more, because they don't feel that they're doing enough. And yet, you know, there's also some commentary coming from, you know, fairly well-known Indian entrepreneurs that live in Silicon Valley, sort of, you know, concurring with that, saying we need to do more to protect the interests of our local marketplace in India and sort of avoid a scenario where they're bullied by the likes of giant international or global tech companies. Tom, I mean, you know, you mentioned already your thoughts, you know, which are quite interesting about how difficult it is to actually make an impact when you're trying to push back on somebody so large. But do you think, you know, what do you think about the role of other associations and organisations, and, you know, are they going to have any clout in this debate and argument?
I think, you know, would like to say, you know, rise up, sort of the like Shea Guevara of the Indian tech startup industry, and like, you know, like rally against Google, bring them down. But the thing is, ultimately, realistically, it's almost how much you put, if you really wanted to do that and those organizations did come together, how much are you willing to lose to actually achieve the goal? Because you'd have to say, let's just not be on the Play Store, which is the shop window to all of their different marketplaces, to actually get the users, to get obviously downloads and growth and things like that. If you were to just come away from that, how much can your business sustain an alternative solution that isn't as strong? And how long can Google and, you know, a big tech last? And, you know, we all kind of know the answers to that. In the short term and medium term, Google wins out every time, because they're global, they've got huge cash reserves, and they could weather that storm. And it's very difficult to make that move, because the biggest part of it is how willing and committed are you to, you know, in the shorter term, potentially losing that revenue, also needing to have more sort of R&D and things into this platform. I think this platform doesn't it's not even something that would be a store in itself where you would download the app locally. You would keep them within your mobile browser, which is almost a different proposition in itself. So it's in many ways would love to sort of agree and say go ahead and rally against this, but bringing all those different organizations and different parties and different things with different points of views into one single perspective fighting against, you know, Google, which is, you know, they're all in the same direction, it's one company, it's quite a big challenge, and it would be great to see, but how costly would that be would really sort of answer that question.
Yeah, and that's a good point. It's like, how deep are your pockets? How patient could you afford to be? And, you know, yeah, I mean, any further thoughts on that, Lindsay? It's like you say, consumers are fickle, but then also organizations are so often hamstrung by financial constraints. Can you see this actually getting anywhere?
I think, I mean, and Google knows this, which is why we're trying to increase the price of the cut they take of in-app purchases to 30%. You know, to in line with what Apple are already charging. But I think that some companies will weigh up, well, how much revenue am I giving Google versus what could any of that revenue be brought back to me building something like this? But as Tom said, it being, you know, a mobile browser functionality, mobile web is a challenging experience for most people most of the time anyway. So if you try and bring anything back into mobile browser, we should be moving away from the browser, not moving back into it. But also with that comes the risk of fraud. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, when Fortnite first announced that they were going to be launching their own kind of mobile version of their browser-based app store, this was, what, a year and a half ago, maybe longer than that, when this first kicked off, that the issue of fraud was the first thing that came up. Because first of all, how are you going to get all these people to use it? But second of all, it's going to be a hotbed for fraud, which, you know, in the in-app environment, these big companies can control that better, where they don't really have dominance or actually experience in mobile web. And that's an interesting point. A lot of these companies are kind of app startups, and the mobile web environment is completely different. So they might not really be able to operate in the same way in that space. Admittedly, some of the app challenges are far greater, and it makes the app companies far more advanced. But again, it's kind of a different ballgame. Are they ready to play in that space? And I think that there's not going to be enough support for them to be able to really get it going. But could there be enough support to kind of get, is it enough to make them heard? I think is probably the kind of threat. And will it make Google, will it make the regulators sit up and see, okay, we need to try and think of a solution to this. But what you don't want is India to go all out, and like they have with China in banning Chinese apps, starting to try to ban Google, you know, like China has done with Google, because you're then going down the kind of the risk of the censorship route, and again, the consumers will just kick off. So it's a really strange balancing act they're kind of in at the moment, I think.
And at an interesting time as well. Sorry, Tom, what are you saying? Yeah, and I, you know, we must move on to the next news story, but I'm just thinking as well, this all comes at a really interesting time as well, because Lindsay, you mentioned, you know, what would be the prospect of them perhaps banning the Play Store or something in the Indian marketplace? Well, actually, Google and other global tech companies have got significant investments in big Indian companies, whether that's oil companies, whether that's infrastructure companies. And it's just such an interesting moment in time, you know, if you compare it with the US attempting to ban TikTok and the implications of that, the slowdown of that, how politicized these issues become. At the end of the day, it brings me back to sort of what I said at the start of the call, which is it all feels like we're trying to kind of patch up a solution when the problem has just been let run wild for too long. It's like the basic bones of the issue is that we've got, you know, one or two companies dominating a particular marketplace, and it's really hard to introduce some kind of diversity when you've let that go for so long. Moving on to story number two. Our very good friends, Terry Kawaja and colleagues over at Luma Partners, have released their Q3 industry report on investment and M&A activity in ad tech and martech. This is always an interesting report. I think this Q3 report deserved a bit of conversation in our podcast because it paints a slightly more optimistic picture, unsurprisingly, than the Q2 report did. But I also think it's hinting towards a few things that perhaps could be indications of how the industry might start imagining, fantasizing about a recovery. It still feels like it could be a long way off, depending on what news sources you might have read on any given day and where in the world you might be living. But a couple of highlights from the report that I wanted your points of view on, please, Tom and Lindsay. It's been the largest, Q3 has been the largest M&A quarter of 2020 across ad tech and martech. Although year on year, the volume's down 40% compared with Q3 in 2019. But the key point here that Luma Partners make is that it's the sequential quarterly increase in deal activity that's making them feel as though the trajectory is moving towards somewhere positive. Digital channels have experienced growth during lockdown, which is something that's been, you know, well documented pretty much from the start of the pandemic. And that's in part contributed to what they're talking about as being the realization of this V-shaped recovery. There was lots of models discussed, you know, back in at the beginning of Q2 as to what recoveries could look like. And, you know, Luma are asserting with this Q3 report that they feel like they can see the beginnings of a V-shaped recovery. And these are the things that that's hinging on. They also point to some high profile acquisitions that have happened over the quarter that we've all, you know, no doubt read a lot about. Epic Games acquiring child safe ad monetization platform Super Awesome. Media Ocean acquiring 4C analytics company. And I just wonder what picture this paints in general. Lindsay, your point of view on this first, please.
I think it's really positive. And I think there's some interesting deals happening at the moment that point to certain growth areas that show that where the money is going, it's going to areas that have been able to grow through lockdown, but also were already kind of growing anyway, and point to areas of innovation. I'm thinking about like identity, I'm thinking about CTV, even audio. But also I think that from an ad tech perspective, it also shows that there's money out there and there's buoyancy in businesses beyond Gaffer. So you're not just relying on Google, Apple, Facebook and Amazon being the behemoths that own these industries, but actually there's more money coming out, like Snowflake's IPO, for example. And looking at the kind of the markup weighting of the trade desk versus all ad tech, which is just insane. Like, so ad tech grew from like 18%. But you take trade desk out of that, ad tech grew 5%. Like, trade desk is just such a, maybe we should start calling it Gaffat or something, because I think the trade desk is going to start becoming kind of that size soon, but it's mental. But I think that it's really interesting. Epic buying Super Awesome is an interesting one, because Epic are looking to gaming is a big thing. And actually, our very own Matt is writing his own gaming investment report that's being released on Monday for the Gaming Economy, which I think we'll publish on Exchange Wire as well, because it's fascinating, because it ties in with this so well. But the Super Awesome deal is going to help make that Unreal Engine kid safe. Now, the joke here is that actually you can't target children on app stores. So there's no advertising for app stores, but everyone knows that that kids use the app stores and use the games anyway. So I kind of also wonder, the ad tech part of Super Awesome, if that's going to be going into something that Peak Games are building, Epic Games even, are building for their own app store, so they can monetize to children more safely. I don't know. That's just that's an interesting thing. But the gaming side's massive, the streaming side's massive, and you've got things like TransUnion buying TrueOptic and Signal. And then you've got... it's obviously identity. So I've already mentioned Snowflake's IPO. You've got InfoSum being invested, I've seen investment from various different partners, including like Experian. And I just think, and even the New York Times buying the Serial podcast and Stitcher being bought as well, just shows you the podcast space is just continuing to grow. So I feel like it's showing there's a lot of excitement and there's money coming back into the market again. But not just the ad tech market, just kind of the market more generally. And you know, DTC is booming. So I think that there's recovery. And I think if we do hit a second wave, well, we already are, but I think very much in a second wave. Obviously, the Luma report is very US focused, but so they're in a constant wave by the looks of things. But it's showing that people are now working out how to do business in spite of that. So in spite of everything going on globally, everyone's working out how we can get back to normal now. And that, I think, is a positive thing here.
And I guess that is the assertion in some of the highlights that they've drawn from their activity in Q3 is they're not just saying this is what's happened in Q3 and it's been really good, but they're saying there's been a prelude to that, which is some stability in things like the direct-to-consumer market, which is, you know, a flight to digital in pretty much every single media channel, you know, which is, again, more sort of, you know, optimism and growth in connected TV and audio channels. So that's what makes it really interesting. I like the Lindsay Roundtree prediction for 2021 there, though, in the midst of all of that, which was Epic Games building their own app store. So watch out for that one.
That targets children. Yeah, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I'm all for that. But also, like, we, you know, we've our other publications, I'm not keep touting other publications, but Fast Growth Bands, like, we our newsletter on that, there is so much investment going to, again, innovative things. So people are looking for innovation, people are looking for sustainability. And this ties in so well with, I think, the world, the direction the world's going in general. So there's money to be had if you are able to change the game.
Yeah, I think Lindsay covered it really well. I think, in terms of some of those kind of major points, I mean, overall, yes, I mean, it is positive. I think probably some of those deals as well that are coming through that they mentioned could be already in the pipeline. And because, you know, over the COVID lockdown period, a lot of things were a bit stilted in terms of what they wanted, or things would have to be staggered out. But it is positive, the fact that those deals are still being materialised. So they're still of value, still of worth. It hasn't been, now that we've had this period, that no longer makes sense. There's still that long-term value there. And I think just, you know, more generally, since that period and since our whole period of lockdown, everything has, it's a very obvious point, but everything that we do have or do is a lot, so much, even more so, more digital than it ever was before. And other demographics as well, so not even just you call millennials or Gen Zs, but even more so like the boomers, for example, because we've all been stuck more indoors a lot more, utilising different services, almost creating new industries whilst doing it as well, because we've got different needs to be satisfied. And I think that for an industry as a whole across digital, that, you know, it's only been positive. There's going to be other industries that, as things rebalance, that are kind of sacrificed as things move more so online. But I think that this report is a reflection of that, you know, whilst we are in economic downturn, whilst we are going to see some of that recovery, I think there is a lot more of a shift towards things being that digitization of things across the board, and that only helps the industry that we're in.
Lindsay, I was just wondering, because Luma make the point that, you know, strong areas for growth in terms of M&A activity have been gaming and CTV. Are we going to see more there? Is this going to change the face of how ad tech and martech starts behaving around gaming and CTV?
I think quite possibly. I think the gaming in and of itself, the gaming industry has a huge amount of investment anyway. So there's always tons of activity going on in gaming, and it's the fact that this is specifically around the kind of the monetization of gaming that is interesting, because I think that is something that's always evolving, and IDFA will be the thing that forces it to evolve to the next stage. So obviously that's been delayed until next year, and you know, the industry is still wondering how that's going to play out. But I think that if you look at how identity has played a big part in Q3 investment, I think identity specifically in the app space will probably play an even bigger part in Q4 or next year's Q1 investment, because it's going to need to. There's going to need to be innovation there, and whether that's from the gaming companies themselves that build their own solutions, or if there's other solutions being built out of what currently exists in the browser space, or similar things being built for the in-app space with these big gaming companies using multiple ID solutions. Like, I don't know yet, but I do. It's gonna definitely be something that's very buoyant, because it has to be, because regulation is forcing it to be.
Yeah, amazing. Got to move us on, because otherwise we're running out of time. Third story I wanted to chat with you guys about: Instagram launching a shoppable feature in Reels. This was inevitable, as far as I could tell, because obviously they need a way to monetize Reels, as they're attempting to do with every other feature within Instagram. You know, Reels was effectively their competitor to TikTok, which they launched back in August. They've already got a shoppable feature on on Instagram TV videos, and they're going to be rolling that out globally because apparently it hasn't been available in all markets. And they're also going to be making those IGTV videos available on an Instagram shop, sort of channel specialist area. So the thing that I thought was interesting about this is that as I'm, in connection with the previous stories we discussed as well, it makes me feel as though, is this, Facebook have talked for a long time about how they want to, maximize their monetization opportunities through payments and payment functionality and payment platforms or commerce-based platforms. But it also feels that they've got an opportunity to almost create like their own, in-app purchasing business model here through Instagram, because at the moment they're not charging any fees up to the end of 2020 for monetization through Reels, but that's going to change, right? And once they've kind of cornered their customers, then they can just start charging fees in the same way that an app store charges fees for in-app purchases. So yeah, just really interested to hear what you think.
Yeah, I think, I think this kind of move is definitely a reflection of the fact that, shareholder pressures and things like that, and constant need to show growth, revenue and opportunities and things like that. I think that's more broadly from their point of view. But I think in when launching something like this, they need to, your points around, making it accessible and not charged for it at this time, they need to know whether it works, they need to test, they need to learn. I think for a lot of advertisers, this will be great, it will be relevant, obviously, of course, within retail, but it does feel that, even at this point, whilst it is a huge part, it is a big part of the market, the, things around, say, the initial things, the newsfeed, for example, are so strong. And for many advertisers, obviously, branching into these other areas offer other opportunities for revenue and incremental based, but it's never going to necessarily at this moment replace. That shift hasn't come. I think even with the introduction of stories, I know obviously the reels are now following, but the monetization even of those is, it does work, but from an advertiser perspective, the effectiveness is still good, but still not always that main cornerstone that might come back to more of their core offering. I think obviously this is something that plays out into the future, and then making sure that all avenues that they are across, they squeeze out all bits of revenue possible where attention may shift. I think it's interesting. I don't necessarily think in this moment it's going to be completely game changing necessarily for everyone. But yeah, obviously there will be brands that it will work extremely well for, sure. But the fact that it's not paid for just yet is that they need to test it, they need to learn, and advertisers need to see the value before they commit even more kind of spend there. But yeah, it certainly is interesting. But it's the other thing with it as well is it just makes me think about innovation and things like that. When they first started, the like button or like the newsfeed, quite big innovations at the time. Obviously, times elapsed, and how good they are now might be different back then. But with these things like the reels, it's very much sort of just almost stifling, isn't it? Stifling the competition, taking that from sort of like TikTok, or taking sort of the stories element from say a Snapchat, and it just strikes me as just is it as innovative and different? Probably not so, just more revenue making sort of exercises and opportunities, and obviously brands can benefit, but it just, yeah, it's a bit philosophical a bit in a way. Want to see more innovation, but that's the business they are now. But it is interesting.
But that's it, 100%. It's about trying to get as much revenue as possible out of and value out of the user base that they've got. But I think the point that you raised there that's really interesting is how much value is this actually going to provide to advertisers, right? Because it's all about finding the right audience, and it will depend heavily on whether the audiences that they need are available in Reels and active in Reels, and then how they find those audiences and what that looks like, particularly in a landscape where personalized targeting is becoming harder and harder. Lindsay, what's your point of view?
So what the bloody hell are Reels? Like, where are they? Are they on Instagram? Are they on Facebook? Where am I supposed to be finding them?
No, they're on Instagram, right? They're like they're the you know, future iteration of stories, from what I can tell.
Right.
The idea is that they're supposed to be very similar to TikTok videos. So, yeah. How do you differentiate how do you differentiate between TikTok videos and stories? Not quite sure.
Well, I mean, yeah. I guess a story, I'm just showing how much I know about social media and Instagram more generally, but I guess obviously a story is something that is time sensitive and only there for 24 hours, and you would have multiple different events happening in one story, where, oh, it's, I guess, a video. But Instagram, I don't understand, because Instagram always does videos, so I'm a bit confused about how this works. But so that's why I'm just like baffled by it in general. But Instagram have proven that shopping has been a massive, massive boon for their platform. And shoppability is like the winner for social. Like, so many, particularly in the DTC age, where so many DTC brands have embraced that only have online platforms. They've embraced shoppability on Instagram, and would definitely embrace it on Reels, whatever that is, too. But I think that it, again, like Tom just mentioned, it shows Facebook's ability to steal good ideas from other people, because they did that with Snapchat. They're doing it from TikTok. Particularly at a time when TikTok is, the future of TikTok is extremely uncertain, along comes Instagram Reels. So brands that might not be comfortable investing in TikTok at the moment because they're not sure what the future of TikTok is, and should they be investing in a company that's under investigation for so many things, they can stick it back into Facebook. The irony of that is, I personally think, rather hilarious, because I'm taking money out of TikTok because it might be unsafe or might be whatever, to put it back into one of the unsafest companies that exists globally. But that's obviously, brands don't think that way. But yeah, I feel it's going to be, the shoppability aspect of it is Facebook focusing so much on shopping. They're focusing so much on shopping and payment, and if they can turn this into something that makes Instagram a place that brands that have some kind of performance aspect to what they're doing, because social historically doesn't have much of a performance aspect to it. Social is much more branding led, but Facebook are making social become much more performance led, which is very, very interesting. And again, like I said, it then helps these direct-to-consumer brands, these kind of brands that only have that are so acquisition-focused, that is where they can get a lot of their money from. And, you know, a bit like Google and paid search, a lot of the revenue that Google gets from paid search actually comes from the SMEs rather than the big P&Gs of the world. And Instagram is probably finding the same thing as well. So Reels and being able to incorporate that will be a big winner for brands, in particular the influencer side of things. So I do think it will be interesting. I don't really know what I said there, but I think I'm just trying to work out throughout all of this what Reels actually is or does.
And so just whilst you were doing that, I was doing a little quick bit of Googling there in the background, and actually point to a really interesting thing there, which is that the only alleged difference between stories and Reels is that stories are considered to be a bit more of a social channel, and Reels is supposed to be more of an entertainment channel. But Reels, and therefore that's why Reels is seen as a direct competitor to TikTok, because that's how TikTok videos started, which were tiny snippets of entertainment pieces. But yeah, I mean, you know, like I can see the look of confusion on your face there, Lindsay, like what the hell has made a difference? And Tom, I'm really interested in your point of view on this at the moment. Already amongst the three of us, difficult to differentiate between the features. Are brands going to be able to differentiate between the features, and are users going to differentiate between the features, or are they just going to, you know, because often how these social platforms you know, grow their user base is just by people kind of slowly drifting towards them. And next thing you know, everybody goes there because the rest of the audience is there. They, you know, and I guess some of it's about functionality, but a lot of it is about a crowd, right?
Yeah, I think as well what Lindsay was saying around the SMEs and things like that, it's because earlier this year as well, they launched obviously their sort of shopping e-commerce platform, and it ties into this as well in the direction that they're going. But it's just leaving no stone unturned. So if there is attention in a certain place, let's make sure that our advertising,
we can monetize it.
Yeah, and like, you know, with the SMEs and things like that, once they get hooked on their Facebook and Instagram shops, they won't go and create websites elsewhere because all their traffic comes from one place, which is, you know, dangerous. That can be dangerous because it's all the control is again with Facebook as opposed to your own standalone sites and things like that. But yeah, I just the actual value and benefit, obviously, of course, it is huge, but it remains to be seen how this will work. It feels more of an initial sort of spoke on the wheel that may eventually become bigger and have more impact. But yeah, it's something that we'd have to see how it plays out. But it just feels like they're covering all bases and making sure that you know, they're investor proof, or they're happy from a business perspective, and all of their products and the things are being maximized monetarily. So
yeah, totally. Okay, on to the second part of the podcast. Tell us what Lean Digital focuses on.
Yeah, so we're a plug and play digital marketing agency. We cover our services across all the kind of digital disciplines, so across programmatic, paid search, paid social, and we basically partner with different businesses, agencies as well, and we provide services that they don't necessarily have from a digital capability, or don't necessarily have the capacity to sort of deliver. So we're a sort of a small boutique kind of collective, as it were, and we partner with also different other collectives, whether that be so for example, they might specialize in you know, out of home, above the line advertising, need a digital function, and we'll collaborate on different projects in that respect. Or it could be the case that business needs a small bespoke digital team to be plugged in to help them accelerate their growth. So they're the kind of areas that we kind of work across, and that niche that we fill. So making sure that we're agile and very much that plug and play boutique solution that is, yeah, there's sort of demand out there for that.
What are some of the things that you've had clients coming to you with, if you can, you know, sort of talk about in more of a general capacity, don't give away any trade secrets, but what are some of the things that you've been working with clients on, particularly over this crazy, crazy year that's been 2020?
Yeah, I mean, it differs. So all of the things are within our specialism. So it is the focus on that on digital. But say, for example, social media and content businesses that specialize in the creative elements, they'll work with us to help amplify everything on a paid perspective. So they focus on what they're doing in terms of creating amazing content, great content for different brands and some of their clients. And then that's the kind of thing that we'll partner with. So from a paid social perspective, different strategy through to execution, we will help promote and assist them in those projects to actually, you know, reach different client goals that we need to do. So that might be on one perspective, and that's been quite big over the period of lockdown on the social side, because of, as we've discussed earlier on, there's been so much more attention, and initially in the first sort of weeks, a bit hairy as people and clients were working out what to do. But then after that, in terms of the projects and things like that, they started to really start to flow because there was opportunity there. And then say on the programmatic side, so we'll have a seat, our seat at our DSP, training desk, and we'll be able to provide that more, because not all of our clients and partners necessarily specialize within, say, the programmatic field, but they might need that as part of a campaign. So it could be tactical, it could be more project-based. They don't need or want to have that infrastructure on a daily basis to manage it, have staff people there in order to do that and build that function of their business. And then they would partner with us for those particular campaigns or projects that require that ability, and we'll work with them in terms of their goals and what is required on that aspect of the bigger campaign planning piece. So yeah, that's a couple of examples of how we would sort of partner with different people and businesses, and it very much is that it's all about the relationships and how we work, and understanding other clients and businesses is the real thing, because it's not just the media, you know, it's not just get this campaign. It's not really, that's not the area that we're sort of in. We definitely like to be partners and in partnership to actually help create the value.
Amazing. And are you seeing demand sort of just, I'm just wondering if any of your experience so far this year is mirrored a little bit what we were talking about in our discussion of the Luma report. Are you seeing demand sort of grow slowly but steadily? Have you got some clients coming to you that you can see are kind of really looking, you know, have kind of sort of, you know, settled into their ways of working at the moment and are therefore looking to the future and quite ambitious about what they want to do next?
Yes, I think yes, definitely. I think I think it's a mix. So there's cautious optimism, and a lot of the metrics and the sort of performance from a lot of clients has been strong, and it does depend on very much on the industry as well. So especially in the sort of higher income brackets and things like that, if you're operating in that space, there's been a lot of opportunity, and there's been, you know, it almost sometimes on some clients it doesn't feel like there's actually been much of a downturn, and you think what is this bubble? During that period, I thought, things are going to ease up a little bit, but they were just unrelentingly more. So in that terms of that V-shaped recovery, I think from a digital aspect, yes. And also, obviously, what's great for us is where you do have more broader scope activity that isn't just digital, and it's the complete campaign planning piece, where investment won't go to things like out of home as much, for example, or won't be spent on TV as much. Some of that then comes over into digital. So that we're seeing. So for us, you know, obviously those industries are suffering a lot more, but from a digital perspective, people that want that more of that trust, know that people are online, all the standard things of the measurability and accountability makes it a bit more of an easier decision for sort of marketing managers in this time, because it's a bit more definitive. It's less, feels less risky at times, and just behavior of people, less people are out, everyone's online. So we're certainly seeing the effects of that. Initially, as I say, I think like most people, the first couple of weeks, everyone was very indecisive. Everyone feared the worst, but yeah, I think a lot of businesses and brands, and especially ones we work with, have adapted to that and taking advantage of the new opportunities that are created and doing things in a slightly different way.
That's really interesting. And I suppose that the last point that I had on that was that, you know, we had a really interesting webcast a couple of weeks ago, during the week that was to Mexico Online and would have been ATS London. And we had Fiona Davis from Captify talking about her perspective. Actually, I think this comment she made was specifically relating to how brands are, you know, sort of engaging and interacting with their tech partners. But it sounds very relevant to what you were saying. She was saying that you know, brands don't want someone just to come in with a certain number of capabilities and, you know, I don't know, provide them with loads of data or provide them with a technology solution that's going to fix this or that or make that better. They actually want something more in addition to that. They want some added insight, or they want some added perspective. They need that little extra bit of something else. And she said it's almost as though we've created a landscape where they want that and need that even more now than they did before. And I wonder if that's maybe something you're finding as well with some of the work you're doing with clients.
Absolutely. And that's the area from my background of working in sort of larger sort of network agencies and things like that. That's something that, you know, it's can be missed at times. But I think that the whole industry is, or the people doing really good innovation in that sense are doing that. So for example, to that point exactly, say Essence, for example, and their pitch with L'Oreal and creating a bespoke function that works for them to drive and power, you know, the kind of work they'll be doing in the future. That trying to adapt and be, that's not just an out of the box solution. This is what we do. These are our capabilities. They're tailoring that and making it. Okay, so it's a big commitment and a big kind of partnership, but that's the kind of model and thinking and where we sit and operate. But it's obviously much easier for us, it's smaller, agile, and we can work on what's great about it as well, as work on projects that are interesting, exciting to us, you know, and meaningful in that sense, because our size and the way that we work allows us to do that. You know, you can be much more collaborative, especially working with people like that and those types of things, and it has changed the shape of the industry a little bit, and it does need to be more collaborative rather than purely we're just the experts and you know nothing. That gap has definitely narrowed quite a lot, and it makes for a richer working experience, and it makes fertile ground for kind of what we want to do and what we do when there's that understanding on the client side of what they might need and what they might want, and it's not always something that's straight off the shelf, you know. So yeah, it certainly is interesting. Yeah.
Amazing. Sounds like there's really good times ahead. Right. We've run out of time. Thank you very much, Tom.
Great. Yeah. Thank you for having me. That was really, really good. Really enjoyed it.
Not at all. Pleasure to have you. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
You didn't have Sebastian digging to Australia with you there today.
No, I was wondering if you'd hear him snoring. He's snoring really loudly.
I actually think this is a ruse. I think Lindsay, like, I mean, if I hadn't actually met Sebastian right about now, I'd be thinking, she doesn't really have a dog. This is just an excuse for strange noises that go on in the background during Mad Tech podcast recordings. Amazing. Which,
yeah, thanks for that.
That could be possible. Amazing. Thank you very much, guys. And that was this week's Mad Tech podcast. In case you missed it, we hosted a webcast earlier in the week discussing how brands are trying to bring together data, content, context, and programmatic. You can catch up on exchangewide.com/webinars. And if you're interested in M&A activity in the gaming industry, then look out for our quarterly TGE Index Investment Report, published this coming Monday, October 12, on thegamingeconomy.com.